This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, June 28th, 2016. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. When the Pope visited the White House last year, that's the band that played, no organ sounds. The president seemed keen, though, to claim a higher power than himself or the divided Congress in the management of global affairs when he spoke to Pope Francis.
You remind us that in the eyes of God, our measure as individuals and our measure as a society is not determined by wealth or power or station or celebrity, but by how well we hew to Scripture's call to lift up the poor and the marginalized.
President Obama at the White House with Pope Francis last September. The president was almost deferential to a pope, suggesting that sovereignty may come from something besides laws and constitutions. Is it the case that policies and programs that seem to be at odds with religious principles can be ignored or declared illegitimate? The Supreme Court deals with that issue all the time.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people.
One can be declared a conscientious objector to avoid a war or draft. Does that apply to immigration policy or to our federal drone policy, to anti-poverty programs, for instance? It seems that to have a legitimate GOP candidate for president, he has to be a born-again Christian conservative, kingmaker, and founder of the popular Focus on the Family group told conservative media that Donald Trump, that's right, Donald Trump passes the test.
He did accept a relationship with Christ. I know the person who led him to Christ.
Really?
And that's fairly recent.
Wow.
And I believe he really made a commitment, but he's a baby Christian.
Mm-hmm.
We all need to be praying for him.
James Dobson is one of America's leading evangelicals, and his interview with Michael Anthony on GodFactor.com has again raised the debate over religion and the role it plays in presidential politics. The Bible means a lot to me, though, is about as specific as Donald Trump has got so far on theological matters. What is the role of religion in the contradictory Obama White House? There are contradictions in every presidency, of course, but the State Department has a special representative for religion and global affairs. It's a first time for such a position. Sean Casey was appointed by John Kerry in 2013, and you could say he acts as a theological and moral barometer for his boss. And his boss's boss. But power? To evoke God and shut something morally offensive down? Actual power? Maybe not.
Everywhere you go, there are religious actors, large, small, and medium, that are having significant impact around the world. And it was Secretary Kerry's belief that we need to have optics into that. We need to interact. We need to go and meet those kinds of religious actors all across the world. And that's what my team and I are doing. So we interpret, we watch, but we're not there trying to influence.
I can see the benefit of that neutrality in this conversation. But let's say you're sitting down with clergy around the world and somebody says to you, Mr. Casey, we love what you're saying, but the drone policy in the United States is it constitutes murder. It's not religious. It's a sin. It violates any number of religious principles. We're angry at the United States. What do you say to that?
Well, I say bring it. That's part of my job, to have a two-way conversation. And if you know anything about religious actors and religious groups, they have opinions. And typically they're not reticent in expressing those opinions. So if my view were, I'm sorry, I can't hear your criticisms, I have to close my ears, I would be a completely ineffective diplomat. So I have to be able to listen. I have to report back what I hear. I have to be an accurate conveyor of their messages back to the State Department in Washington, D.C. So it very much is a two-way information flow. Now, that means sometimes I'm come back to Washington and I'm the bearer of bad news. But that is part of what diplomacy is about. If you're going to have a true diplomatic exchange, that means you have to accept the good, the bad, and the critical. So trust me, I've been on the receiving end of exactly those kinds of criticisms, both moral and theological and political, and that's been part of the package from the beginning.
You've had a great run here with both the Obama campaign, the State Department, and of course your scholarship is well known. But you're also a moral person with a deep set of convictions. Has that ever been challenged? that basically you were representing something that you didn't feel good about, and you had to talk to yourself, talk to your family. It was a tough moment for you.
Certainly. I mean, radio show hosts probably have moments where you wake up and say, do I really want to do this or did I do that as the most effectively as I could? There are challenges like that. But different actors have to make decisions about where their moral thresholds are. You know, can I?
But I don't feel morally compromised as a radio host. I may feel like I had a bad day or that I really stank in the interview.
Yeah.
I mean, you're more in the potentially morally compromised mode.
Sure. So a couple of things. Number one, I think you always have to be attentive. I think the danger is you find yourself working in a bureaucracy and the temperature goes up a half a degree a day and before you know it, you might be boiling if you're not attentive. But at the end of the day, I think for me the threshold is the general direction and arc of an administration that I might be working with going in a direction that I am in deep sympathy with. It's a big, complex government. There's not a single human being who's going to agree 24/7 with everything that goes on in the government of the United States. I mean, I've yet to encounter the person who's ever worked in government who says, yes, I buy it all
right,
the time.
Then let's do it like a baseball diamond, all right?
So first base
is Nobel Prize winning Barack Obama has a kill list. That's base one. Base two is Nobel Prize winning Barack Obama goes to Hiroshima and doesn't apologize.
Right.
Base three is Nobel Prize winning Barack Obama is the deporter in chief, according to Hispanic leaders in the United States. Which one of those bases is the hottest for you morally, Sean Casey?
So what I would say is you need a deeper examination of what's going on all three of those bases. The drone policy is now governed by a set of laws and rules and multiple eyes and multiple assessors. It's not the president in the Oval Office saying, okay, today I want to do this.
You sure about that?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Secondly, what was the second issue?
Second one was not apologizing at Hiroshima.
Okay. But what he did say was, and what his policy shows, is we're moving towards what someday will be a nuclear-free world. Okay. So he's looking forward. He's not looking backward to relitigate the decision that he had no impact on, that he did not participate in, that actually happened before any of us happened to be born. Okay. So I think the thing to keep in the view with respect to the Hiroshima visit is what are we trying to do now in terms of reducing the number of nuclear weapons around the world? I would argue this administration has made great progress in reducing the danger and reduce – now, if that were not the case
– you would be upset.
I would be upset.
Third base, deporter-in-chief. What do you think?
Well, he is trying to fix a broken system, okay? And what he's trying to do is to resolve the root causes both in the – say in this case, in the triangle down in Central America and what are causing the flows of the unaccompanied minors and the undocumented folk. All right. He's looking for a systematic political policy solution to that. He hasn't had a lot of success in finding willing partners on the other side of the aisle.
If he wasn't doing that, looking for partners bit, you would be upset about the deportations.
I certainly wouldn't – I'm not happy with the status quo. I don't think the president's happy with the status quo.
If it's a Washington Nationals, Boston Red Sox World Series, Kerry is clearly Red Sox. Where do you stand, sir?
Oh, boy. This may be the diciest moral question you've asked me. I actually grew up a St. Louis Cardinals fan. I hold the land speed record from Paducah, Kentucky, where I grew up, to Old Busch Stadium. In this particular moral dilemma, I'd be with the Red Sox.
A very candid Sean Casey, State Department Special Representative for Religion and Global Affairs. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, John.
We got to separate ourselves. We got to flat out separate ourselves on the board. It's a team that really wants it, that has everybody committed to what they have to do. We got to have communication. But we must have composure. We got it? See how tough we are.
Let's go, 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 go.
Listen to that voice and the strong philosophy in those words. The words of legendary college basketball coach Pat Summitt, who died today at the age of 64. In her 38-year career, she molded a dynasty at the University of Tennessee, leading the Lady Volunteers to 8 national championships. She's also the leader in all-time wins by a Division I college coach, men or women's, with 1,098. Summit reached the Final Four 18 times and even achieved perfection during the 97-98 season with a 39-0 record, a team led by All-Americans Shamika Holtzclaw and Tamika Catchings.
And that's it. The Lady Volunteers. The first team ever to go 39-0. And they have won their third straight national championship. Unprecedented in the NCAA.
When you think about the determination and you think about all the things that Pat has been able to accomplish, a lot of it has come from her determination, and she's had so many trials and tribulations throughout her life. But look at her. You know, she's still standing strong.
Summit was tough as a coach, her style indelibly imprinted on the women she coached. Tamika Catchings recalls the moment she knew she wanted to play for Tennessee.
First time I saw Pat coaching, I was a seventh grader, and I just happened to be flipping through the channels, and I remember on the screen, it was her eyes, you know, just the determination and the passion and just the love. And I mean, that's all the thing that you want in a great coach. For me, it was like, man, I want to play for this woman.
In her own career, Summit played for University of Tennessee at Martin, became the assistant coach when she graduated in 1974 and played on the 76 Olympic basketball team. 8 years later, she coached the U.S. women's team to its first Olympic gold medal. In 2012, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Obama. One of Summit's toughest battles, though, was with early-onset dementia, which forced her to retire at the age of 59. Here's Summit opening up about her diagnosis in 2011.
Well, I just, I just felt something was different. And, you know, at the time, I didn't know what I was dealing with. And until I went to the Mayo Clinic, I couldn't be for sure, but I can remember, trying to coach and trying to figure out schemes and whatever, and it just wasn't coming to me like I typically would say, oh, hey, we're going to do this, going to run that. I think it probably caused me to, you know, second guess.
Summit lost the memory of those precious victories and championship moments long before she died. But they can never be lost in the minds of those she touched as a winner, as a coach, and a mentor to two generations of women basketball players and just women. Pat Summit, dead at the age of 64.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
A segment we like to call Anthropology by Google, or News by Google. Actually, it matters in this particular case. One of the top Googled questions last week after Brexit, the British exit from the EU, was what is the EU? I love that. And that was Google's from England. The simple answer is there is no simple answer. And the United Kingdom's elbow shove to Brussels to leave the European Union is not the end of the matter by any means. The exit hinges on what is called an Article 50 notification. And that's just the beginning. By the way, the top Googled item today, we think, is what is Iceland from the UK. But that's a soccer matter, and we'll talk about that a little later this hour. Pippa Malmgren, is founder of the economic advisory firm DRPM Group and author of the soon-to-be-released book Signals, How Everyday Signs Can Help Us Navigate the World's Turbulent Economy. By the way, Malmgren was also a former advisor to George W. Bush. Can we unravel this?
It is quite possible that Britain doesn't actually exit the European Union, but they negotiate some kind of new status that lets them pay something in, get the benefits, but not be obliged to take all the legislation that the European Union provides, which is really the big complaint. The British want control of their own law back.
What authority does this referendum have legally right now?
Well, technically, it's just an advisory measure is what they call it in British legal terms. But politically, the public feel they have voted. And all of the people who live in London, Scotland and Northern Ireland who voted for staying now are like, oh, we should have another vote. But gosh, that is going to outrage the general public here who feel like they said what they wanted. And that was to regain control of their sovereign power. And failure to deliver that will be a political catastrophe.
But is there really a problem with British sovereign power? I mean, there are certain things that relate to, you know, dealing with other countries in the EU. But there's a lot of things that average folks on the street don't have power over, and it doesn't affect their sovereignty.
Oh, I'm not so sure that's right. And I'll give you a couple examples. Last year, the Commission, which is the ruling authority in the European Union, put on the table full harmonization of bankruptcy, employment, and corporate law. And you know they're not going to take the British model and impose it on the French. They're going to take the French model and impose it on the British. The British are like, we don't want to have that kind of corporate environment. And they would have been obliged to accept it had they stayed inside the European Union. And there are lots of smaller examples, like the European Union telling you, you know, what kind of kettle you can have to boil your tea in. It just drives people insane as they get more invasive.
And, I mean, there are a lot of laws in Britain that drive people insane, but because they're British laws and sovereignty is presumed, even though it's the parliament or some local municipal authority that made those laws, that's not as infuriating as having some French folks across the channel do it?
Yeah, and I'll tell you the profound difference is that at least in the British system, you have recourse and you can overturn the rules and the law. Within the commission, once the commission has ruled and announced a new law, there is no recourse.
Well, there's this.
And, there's this, yeah, which is a pretty extreme example, right, of recourse.
Recourse with a capital R. Could there have been another configuration of the commission that would have been more palatable to the raging Democrats that suddenly have emerged here in the UK?
Yeah, without a doubt. So the original European Union was basically a club of member nations. And the only issues that went up to the Commission were ones where it couldn't be negotiated amongst the member states any other way. But everybody got to retain their own rules, their own laws. The new EU, it has morphed into a very aggressive, top-down kind of structure that imposes lots of things on the member states, whether they like it or not. That's what everybody who's involved in the exit movement, whether they're in Britain or they're on the continent, is irritated about. They could sign up for the original EU, but the current EU is a vastly different animal.
A comment finally on this clash between what plays as a kind of sense of style, although bureaucracy is often a little more entrenched than style, and this European project that everyone talks about in these whispered tones, really for the last 40 years, this abstract idea of Europe emerging from a Napoleonic nightmare and becoming a union of some sort. Is that idea dead? Does it exist now just in the abstract? What do you think?
Well, yeah, this is the fundamental issue. A Europe that's a bunch of member states is one thing, and everybody liked that idea. A Europe that has one finance minister, one secretary of state equivalent, that one people aren't so comfortable with. And the idea of a European Union army, for example, which, you know, clearly this is the direction they want to go in because they want to create something that's on a par with the United States. But that's the commission and the bureaucrats. The general public is saying, you know, I'm not sure that's working for me. So I think some will continue trying to push in that direction. And a whole lot of people are throwing up red flags of objection.
But there were people a year ago who were saying in the middle of the Greek crisis that if you don't have political control, you'll never have a European Union. It was basically the other argument. Without political control, you're meaningless. Now, with political control, you're meaningless. I don't get it.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, here's the bottom line. When the European public have been offered the opportunity to hand over their fiscal and political sovereignty to Brussels, every single time they have declined. They said, no, I don't want to do that. And they're watching what's happening in a country like Greece, which has deteriorated into fundamentally a failed state. And they basically blame Brussels for that. Now, that may be putting the blame in the wrong place. But the idea that Brussels can better govern than your locally elected officials is definitely popular amongst some in the European Union, but it seems to be increasingly unpopular for the general public.
That EU flag's kind of nice, though. It'd make a good comforter. I mean, bedspread, yeah. Curtains.
Well, now it's so funny. The new image is with one of the stars fallen out, which is the British.
At the top or at the bottom?
At the bottom.
Pippa Malgram is founder of the economic advisory firm DRPM Group and the author of the soon-to-be-released book Signals, How Everyday Signs Can Help Us Navigate the World's Turbulent Economy. You'll have a little subtitle there. It said, I called the Brexit, right?
Well, I explain in the book why we have these movements and why it's part of a global phenomenon that we need to understand.
Thanks, Pippa.
Thank you.
How about one of the canal boat songs? Do you know this one? I got a mule and the name is Sal. 15 miles on the Erie Canal. She's a good old worker.
The old Erie Canal. Sing it, Pete Seeger. From Albany to Buffalo, it's not actually the size that could ever take a Chinese mega container ship. From 1825, the canal's construction back then was an engineering marvel and a DIY project worthy of Silicon Valley 170 years later. The canal is now not much more than a tourist attraction kept afloat by the 21st century service industry, but a new book looks back at the fusion of religion, economics, and politics that happened during the canal's initial years, when strange ideas came to backwoods New York to foster new, distinctly American ways of commerce, even new religions. I said at the beginning of the hour that the Erie Canal actually paved the way for the cartoon comedy South Park.
All right, kids, now how about we do some scripture readings from the Book of Mormon?
All right!
Ow! That's right. Child of the canal, Joseph Smith, created Mormonism. Without Smith, I think it's safe to say, no South Park, no Book of Mormon. All right, that maybe is a stretch. But the book that really explains all of this is called Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal, and its author is Jack Kelly, who says that the visionary energy along the Erie Canal helped create modern America.
I was interested in the sort of outbreak of visionary energy that came about along the path of the Erie Canal after it opened. I think what connects a lot of the people that I talk about in the book is the idea of youth. We look back and see these images of people in those days with the mutton chops and the frock coats. But the people that went to the canal were really young people. They wanted a new religion. They wanted a new type of politics, ranging from Joseph Smith, who founded Mormonism right on the canal, to Charles Finney, who was the Billy Graham of the 19th century, and also just oddballs like Sam Patch, who was America's first professional daredevil. And Andrew Jackson actually named his horse Sam Patch, I guess because he was a great jumper.
That's so amazing. Part of this visionary youthful business relates to the actual building of the canal in the sense that the canal was a DIY kind of a project that in many ways it was dug using very, you know, primitive technology, and it was the absence of cement that really held up the canal. And explain how the canal itself would be built for a while and then would stop as they awaited the kind of cement that they would need to build the locks, which is, of course, essential for any canal.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to think today that the canal cost between $7 and $8 million at the time. Projecting the cost of labor in today's dollars, some people project that to be about $174 billion with a B, for the state to set off on a project like that and not really even know where they're going to get the materials, not have professional engineers. Well, there were no professional engineers, and it was planned and pretty much built by amateurs who learned on the way. And I think the reason for that these people were so adaptable, was that they were men of the frontier, and you really had to have a lot of self-sufficiency and inventiveness in order to cope with the sort of improvisation of going up against nature and the frontier. Things as simple as, how do you pull out a stump of a tree that in these virgin forests, you have trees 150 feet high. think that they were, you know, some very creative minds went to work there, and they solved every problem they came up against and completed the canal in 8 years, which people were amazed it was able to build it that quickly.
Creative mind doesn't even begin to describe what Joseph Smith was all about, though. On some level, Mormonism itself is this dramatic metaphor for the settling of the West and the creation of what we understand as this American Western spirit.
Yeah, I think that, you know, people were looking for something new. Like a lot of people, I was a little skeptical when I started reading about Joseph Smith, who was the founder of the Mormon religion. He found the Golden Plates and translated the Book of Mormon. There's a strangeness to his vision that makes it a little bit inaccessible to us today if we're not Mormons. In reading about him and researching him, I came to really appreciate him as one of the great imaginative geniuses of the 19th century. First, to produce the book, which was 600 pages, had more than 300 characters, plots within plots, flashbacks, a great epic story, and then to take that book and form a religion around it. And this is a young man who was a farm laborer and had very little education. It was an incredible achievement. It almost boggles the mind.
The claim is made that New York as a financial center became that way because of the canal, because of the success of the canal and the trade implications of that. Is that true? And is there a place in New York City where you can see some sort of tangible evidence of the canal's influence on Wall Street?
To go back and look at the situation when the canal was proposed, New York State was a relatively small state. We have to remember New York City was still just at the tip of Manhattan and the Hudson Valley, and that was pretty much all. The rest of New York State was largely undeveloped. And so it was a great risk for the state to put the substantial portion of all the capital in the state into one project. And they went through New York City to sell bonds, to attract capital. And not only did it make New York City the financial capital, which it remains today, but the flow of goods through the city made it into the greatest port.
What was shuttled up and down the canal, and who travels the canal today?
Well, the commercial traffic on the canal, which brought lumber, coal, and hay, as they say, down from the interior, and manufactured goods and immigrants, and many both foreign immigrants and people from New England and New York and the East Coast who wanted to travel to the West. That was the great commercial traffic of the Erie Canal. And today it's largely a tourist attraction. It's still kept open. The locks are available for any pleasure boat or yacht that wants to go down. It has a certain viability, and it's certainly a wonderful artifact of the 19th century, though it's not commercially viable anymore.
Jack Kelly is the author of Heaven's Ditch, God, Gold, and Murder on the Erie Canal. He spoke with us from Albany, New York, the site of the original beginning of the canal. Chuck Kelly, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
We hauled some barges in our day, filled with lumber, coal, and hay. And we know every inch of the way from Albany to Buffalo. Low bridge, everybody down. Low bridge, for we're coming to a town. And you'll always know your neighbor, you'll always know your pal, if you ever navigated on the Erie Canal.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Hey, soccer fans, poor Lionel Messi, poor Argentina.
Can Messi put Argentina in front? He missed it!
Don't cry for Lionel Messi, perhaps the greatest soccer player in the world. He still is, but he took a penalty kick, that penalty kick at the end of the final game of the Copa America against Chile, and lofted it over the crossbar. Now, would we call that a choke? Did he choke? Some of the Argentinian fans believe it was. Did he have some bad luck? What is this thing called choking under the turbulent pressure of sports at the very highest level? With us is Ben Littleton, author of 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty. This one hurts, Ben. What do you think?
Is Messi a choker? Well, he did choke at the weekend, but I don't think that makes him a terminal choker. The thing about penalties is they're a hugely pressured situation. Now, any professional who's good enough to play for his country should score a penalty kick because it's a free shot from 12 yards with only one player in the way, just the goalkeeper to beat. But so many big players, some of the greatest players of all time, have missed this kick. This is the latest in a series of penalty misses for Lionel Messi. And if he's ever going to be seen as the greatest player to have ever played the game, he needed to win a trophy with the Argentine national team. This was his chance to do so. And I just wonder if the pressure got too much for him.
If you miss a penalty kick and then talk about retirement, is that a sign of choking?
I think it's a sign of taking it very badly.
Yeah.
and a sign of being over emotional and letting your head rule your heart. Now, this was a really strange situation for Messi to be in because it's a final against Chile. 1 year ago, Argentina were in another final against Chile. They lost it on penalties. A year before that, Argentina were in another final, World Cup final against Germany. Argentina lost that. Messi has never won a title with Argentina. And in the background, you have the specter of Diego Maradona saying, well, Messi's never won anything with this team. And I won this team the World Cup. There is so much additional pressure on Messi every time he steps up. So all these things combine to add to the pressure. And it's proven in academic studies that players who have won lots of individual awards actually have a worse penalty record than the same players from before they won the awards. And the only explanation that can be given for that is that the pressure on the same player increases as they gain these awards. So the greater the individual award, the more pressure is on that player.
So conversely, then, if you don't have pressure, that could mean a fantastic standout performance.
Absolutely.
For instance, Iceland, Ben.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's a great example. Thank you very much for bringing that up so soon in
the show.
I'm very pleased you got that out the way.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's true. It's true. The England players in that game against Iceland had so much extra pressure on them that when it came to it, they didn't know how to cope with it. And it was as much a failure of mentality, psychology, and ability to perform under pressure as it was about technique.
Let's talk about some American sports or American sports figures anyway, just for a moment here. Are you familiar with the Buffalo Bills and the Minnesota Vikings in the NFL?
Yes.
I mean, they are chokers, right?
Well, I think there can be a history of a team that performs badly when the pressure is on or when they're not expected to. And I think it leaves a trauma as well. Now, there's lots spoken about the idea that negative trauma outweighs positive trauma. And the fact that if one bad thing happens to you in your day and loads of good things happen, you'll focus on the bad thing. And this happens in sports as well. So if a team consistently falls short at the last, like England's soccer team do and those NFL teams you've mentioned, then I think it carries on happening, almost becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, even if the players are different players. And again, back to penalties, studies show that if a team loses a shootout, it is more likely to lose the next shootout, whether or not the same players are wearing those shirts. So even if it's a different set of players, the fact that that team is associated with a penalty defeat means that the next time it happens, it's more likely to repeat.
All right. So how about Andy Murray, choker in tennis?
I would say not. I would say Andy Murray has won Wimbledon. He's won the Olympics. He is up against some incredible talent. First of all, Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer, now one of the best players ever to play tennis. We're talking about Novak Djokovic, who could break all records for Grand Slam titles. I think Murray has become a better player because he's been surrounded by this greatness rather than a guy who falls short at the last. I would say he is definitely not a choker.
But he does need to have more fun, yes?
He's actually quite fun. I think he needs to lighten up on the court a bit, but away from it, I think he's quite fun.
All right. I wonder if you know about this moment, going back to America for a minute.
Little roller up along first, behind the bag. It gets through Buckner. Here comes Knight, and the Mets win it.
October 6, 1986, Mets versus the Red Sox, 10th inning, game six. I mean, Americans would say that Bill Buckner, and I'll give you a sense of his wounded voice here, speaking about the possibility of choking. Here, listen.
The dreams are that you're going to have a great series and win, and the nightmares are that you're going to let the winning run score on a ground ball through your legs. So, you know.
Look, this is something that he will never be allowed to forget, and I think even now he's associated with it. And the same is true in, you know, these moments of high pressure in all sports.
The art and psychology of the perfect penalty you've written about, but is there an art and psychology to recovering from the perfect choke?
Well, I think there has to be, yes. And I think it's to try and get on the horse as quickly as possible afterwards. And, you know, by Messi's comments, by saying, right, enough, I've lost four finals out of four, another penalty shootout, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm retiring, I think is not the right way to do it. I think you just have to keep on going. And a lot of champions will say that resilience, persistence, and perseverance has been the key to their success. And Novak Djokovic is a perfect example. I mean, he lost so many times to Federer and Nadal in finals before he finally came good.
And it's also possible that, you know, volcanic water in Iceland is really good for you.
Well, let's all hope so. I think speaking from an island that is on the cusp of change with a clear insular mentality, I'm hoping that England can take some positive lessons from the Iceland scenario.
That's the most brilliant analysis I've heard, actually, all week long. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Ben Littleton is the author of 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty. We're going to leave you with some stories that you told us about chokes go way beyond sports. Grand Prairie, Texas. I choked and started crying during an interview for a really awesome job when grilled about why I was leaving my current job, which I was already very torn about, and I didn't get the other job.
Hi, this is Barbara from Honolulu, Hawaii. Divorced. Thought I could not have a life without him. Lost weight, took antidepressants, had a friend sleeping on the floor next to me for months. My mother came to make sure I ate breakfast and got to work. On June 28th, we will celebrate 24 years of a happy marriage. So while I choked and was sure I would die, I am alive and well.
Nice cutback there, Barbara. Seattle, Washington. Years ago, I was meeting relatives of my then new father-in-law's second wife. One of them told a horrid racist joke. Several people laughed. I was stunned, grabbed my kids, and left the room. Of course, no one missed us. Later, I realized that no matter the fallout, I should have said something. These days, I do. Good lesson. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the stories. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.